Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, the political scientist Leo Panitch will discuss the new premier of his home province of Ontario, Doug Ford. And at the bottom of the hour, the psychologist and historian of science, Cordelia Fine, will discuss her book, Testosterone Rex, a takedown of a lot of mythology surrounding that notorious hormone. On June 7th, the province of Ontario held an election for its legislature. The Liberal Party, which not unlike our Democratic Party, is a mix of moderate progressives and loyal servants of capital, led by Kathleen Wynne, which had governed the province since 2003, suffered the worst defeat of a governing party in Ontario history. They got less than 20% of the popular vote and went from 55 seats in the provincial legislature to 7. The winner was the Progressive Conservative Party, a.k.a. the Tories, which got just over 40% of the popular vote and 76 seats, a solid majority. The New Democratic Party, led by Andrea Horwath, a social democratic formation, has moved right, like many left parties around the world in recent decades, came in second with 34% of the popular vote and 40 seats. Under the parliamentary system, the Tory leader Doug Ford, an ignorant reactionary, becomes the Premier of Ontario on June 29th. Ford is the brother of the late infamous Rob Ford, the crack-smoking, booze-addled mayor of Toronto from 2010 to 2014. What does it all mean? How has Ontario become the latest beachhead of the Trump International? Are the American left's fantasies about Canada being a much nicer place than here really justified? Here's Leo Panitch, a frequent guest in Behind the News, to answer those questions. Leo is a professor emeritus of political science at York University in Toronto. His book, The Socialist Challenge Today, Syriza, Sanders, Corbyn, co-authored with Sam Gindin, is just out from Merlin Press. I'll have Leo and or Sam on soon to talk about the book. Here is Leo now to talk about Fordism, Ontario style. Leo Panitch. So in our simple-minded American way, we're casting the election of Doug Ford as Ontario's Trump. How accurate is that?
In some ways, very accurate, in the sense that one of the things that attracts people like Trump and Ford to ordinary voters is that they sound like the guy in the tavern. They can recognize him. His inconsistencies, his bluster, both of theirs, are something they identify with, even their know-nothingness. In that sense, they're very, very similar. Plato once said that democracy is the regime of ignoramuses. And in both cases, one can say that, unfortunately, Plato is being confirmed at the beginning of the 21st century as I think, a product of the miseducation that the mainstream media and the mainstream parties engaged in. I mean, just dumbing people down. So in that sense, they're similar.
Ford himself comes from a political family, unlike Trump, right?
Yeah, but so what? I mean, his father was a small businessman who had a cabinet post in a very right-wing government in Ontario, the Harris government in the mid-1990s. He himself was a drug dealer, as he admits, in his teenage years and into his 20s. He has run his father's business. He's clearly less of a loose cannon than his brother was when he was mayor of Toronto. That said, this guy has no great intellect, nor does he know damn all about politics. I mean, it became clear during the election campaign that he doesn't even know how legislation gets passed. And his handlers simply had him repeating the most basic of lines. He was, much, much more cautious than Trump to not shoot his mouth off, because when he does, he shows it, how ignorant he is.
Now, what about ties to elites? Trump has, at best, an ambiguous relationship with business and political elites. What about Ford?
Yeah, he plays the exact same line. It's somewhat true, but on the other hand, because, as you say, he comes from a conservative party political family, he's obviously had ties both with the bourgeoisie at the highest level, or not ties, I mean, acquaintances with, but also with the most establishment cabinet ministers who have been to his family's, annual barbecues and Christmas parties and so on. where he's really, I think, different than Trump is that there's no evidence of racism. On the contrary, he has a base in certain black communities. That's important, I think, that this whole anti-immigration thing and the undercurrents of racism, he didn't play on. And therefore, although he clearly had a working class vote, although that really needs to be qualified and we should talk about that more, one can't say it was a white working class vote exclusively, that he, you know, it was white privilege that they were voting for. No, that's not what's going on here.
What about misogyny?
Yes. One of the most stunning things that I really can't explain is why Kathleen Wynne became so unpopular. We need to talk a bit about the legacy of the Liberal Party and the burden she had to carry with regard to all kinds of shenanigans they'd engaged in. But she was very popular for a period. And then she just tanked. And I think one has to say that there's an element of homophobia going on there because she is a lesbian, openly has her partner with her in all public events, etc. I think that may be a factor. A second factor, more important than misogyny perhaps, is that the liberals introduced some extended sex education in the primary schools. And many traditional communities, not least, again, immigrant communities, Muslim communities, the Asian communities, found that very hard to take. And there were massive protests against it for a while. Ford played to that. He got rid of one of the people who had been candidates against him for the leader when she was going to be nominated as a candidate in a local riding. Because she was so over the top about this. But he's played to this, and he's promised that he would cut that back. That probably was as big a factor as in any homophobia going on. Misogyny, no, since the leader of the NDP is a woman, and actually one that ran to the right of Kathleen Wynne in the last election. We have the Social Democratic Party, which, as has been the case with so many Social Democratic parties, accommodated themselves to the neoliberal tax appeal, anti-tax appeal of the right. And this woman in the last election ran on, you know, somewhat of a Tea Party platform, appealing to small business, rural communities, anti-tax stuff. This time, has she learned her lesson? And ran to the left of the liberals. But in any case, this was another woman, and she gave Ford, you know, a bit of a run for his money, and while the liberals completely tanked.
All right, one more Ford question, then I want to talk about the other parties. But people here speak somewhat recklessly about Trump's base. There are many kinds of Trump voters. You know, there are suburban Republicans who just want tax cuts and deregulation. There are discontented working class, white working class people who just want to flip the bird to the elites. There are people who find the xenophobia and authoritarianism really appealing, you know, some sort of crypto-Nazis or neo-Nazis or whatever you want to call them. What about the Ford base? Is there anything comparable?
I totally agree. I think there's this multidimensional overlapping set of factors behind all of these authoritarian populist politicians that have emerged everywhere. As we've said, you know, it's anti-elitist, it's anti-tax, it's anti-immigrant, it's homophobic, it's old classes above all trying to hold on to their tax cuts or to get even more. It's working class people stupidly thinking that, you know, a $20 tax cut or a $200 tax cut will do them any good while, you know, their children's schools are completely destroyed, denuded of inequality. I think it's a product of confusion and self-interest, you know, mixed together in overlapping ways. And to find a unique base to this, although there are, of course, in some communities, you know, whether it's rich suburbia, rich white suburbia, or certain, in the Trump's case in particular, certain Midwest industrial communities that, you know, finally, having been opposed to NAFTA in 1992, have got their, you know, been able to pay the Democrats back for having given them the bird over this for so long. But it's all very overlapping and very confused. I want to reiterate, though, that although there was a Trump working class vote, and I think identifying with him because he sounds like the guy in the bar, the traditional working class communities, those equivalent to Michigan or working class Pennsylvania, et cetera, where industrial unionism has traditionally been strong, where the community itself is comfortable in those traditions. In the Ontario case, those communities voted NDP. And that's very significant, I think. Even if the same people aren't there, even if there's been a decline in the number of union members, the legacy of that union culture in those communities, whether it's in steelworkers Hamilton or in auto workers Windsor, you know, that really held in this election. It was very marked.
Okay, and now the other parties. The Liberals did not have an impressive record in office running Ontario, did they?
Well, I think this is also very mixed. It was actually, in some ways, a very progressive government, a left Liberal government. It introduced the most progressive labor legislation Ontario has seen since the early 90s. That included a $14 minimum wage, which was a massive hike from $10, which was introduced this past January, and that was to go up to $15 next January. But it also involved extensive improvements on labor standards, especially for precarious workers. So this was important. It could have gone further, of course, but it was important. And as I said, in terms of sex ed, in terms of support for diversity, in terms of support for civil liberties and human rights, openness to the Syrian refugees, you know, all that stuff, they were good. On the other hand, and they even ran the deficit, I have to say, and were not ashamed of running it, although they may have paid for it somewhat. On the other hand, they privatized the public utility Ontario Hydro. Not entirely. They privatized a portion of it in order to, they claimed, be able to use the $9 billion they got for that to build public transportation. There was a lot of opposition to that in the population generally, not just from the unions. 70 to 80% of people consistently said they were against the privatization of Hydro. Why this was such a problem is that it was mixed up with a number of things. One was vastly increased hydro rates, especially for households, which had to do with trying to raise money to shift towards alternate energy and to expand the number of plants. Secondly, the Liberals, Wynne's predecessor, McGuinty, had a plan to build two gas-fired power generators for electricity. And NIMBY kicked in a couple of places where they were going to build them. They were Liberal strongholds. And, yeah, long after they had signed the contract, they canceled those two in the run-up to the 2011 election. That they said that was going to cost them, in order to compensate the companies involved, some $300 million, it ended up costing them over $1 billion for building them elsewhere, but above all, for compensating the New York hedge funds that had provided these companies with the bonds to do this. There was no legal obligation to compensate the companies at all, but the companies claimed they would have a legal obligation to the investment houses that had provided them with the money. And, you know, Ontario is always looks to New York and how their bonds, the Ontario bond, will be treated on the New York bond market. So they paid through the nose. And this was an enormous scandal. And it came up in the campaign, not only in terms of, you know, all of the politicians pointing at this, but One of McGinty's people in his office had wiped out his hard drive in order for there not to be evidence of the email trail on the decision to cancel these plants or to compensate the companies. So he was actually convicted right during the middle of the election campaign in a trial that had gone on forever to 4 months in prison.
I'm speaking with the Toronto-based political scientist Leo Penich. And the NDP, Social Democratic Party, with a long history, has moved right, moved left, kind of hard to keep track of it. What's latest?
It moved in the direction of the third way of Blairism, and as I said, even tried to, you know, run after the Tea Party a little in the election before last. It moved back to the left. It promised to bring Ontario Hydro back into public ownership. But then again, one needs to be very careful with this. Ontario Hydro, when it was brought into being at the beginning of the 20th century, was brought into being for businessmen. It was run by businessmen in a businesslike manner. The reason it was brought into being is that a shyster had cornered the market in Niagara Falls Energy and was charging enormous rates. And that was undermining the ability of Canadian manufacturers to compete with American manufacturers. So this was a collective businessman's project to nationalize the sector, the energy sector, in order to provide what they called public energy. But it was done above all so that manufacturers in Ontario could compete with manufacturers in New York State, etc. Now, you know, ironically, the Labour Party politicians in Britain at the time pointed to that as the socialist experiments of the Dominions. The typical way that social democrats misunderstand the nature of the capitalist state. So, you know, in proposing, you know, to bring Ontario Hydro back into the public sector, this was in no sense a socialist program. Nevertheless, you know, she did run on some good programs. I mean, that one is not a bad one, but, you know, also to extend child care benefits in a much broader way than even the Liberals were promising, although they were promising a lot in that respect, and around progressive taxation and labor rights and so on. But, you know, there wasn't all that much to choose from between the Liberals and the NDP. The tragedy is that having gotten 60% of the vote together, we're now going to see Ontario Hydro completely privatized. We're going to see an extension of subways run by PPPs, by public-private partnerships, all of which, of course, is enormously expensive. You know, we'll see. One of the reasons that he had a great appeal, I'm sorry to say, is that he promised a 10% cut on the gasoline tax. And people vote for that kind of thing. The same kind of people who, you know, will say we're in favor of green energy. And he already has put a cut on any hirings in the public sector, and he has already ended subsidies to adopting green energy in your household. So this is going to be an extremely reactionary government. And where I do think he is similar to Trump is that if there is a dust-up with the police between demonstrators and police at you know, at some event, he will be 100% behind the most heavy-handed tactics of the coercive apparatus of the state. And that'll be ugly.
American leftists tend to romanticize Canada, I'm sure you know, but it should be made clear that this is far from the first right-wing Ontario government in recent history, right?
Absolutely, and they have no business romanticizing Canada. They misunderstand the nature of the NDP. It's only because you guys are on your knees that we look tall. So, no, of course not. You know, in fact, at the federal level, until the Trudeau Liberals, who are hardly revolutionaries, to put it mildly, we had, you know, much more right-wing government than you guys did in the Harper Conservatives in every conceivable respect, however disappointing Obama was.
And then, of course, there's the Mike Harris regime some time back.
Yes, and you know, then that was an extremely reactionary regime, which the Ford regime, even with its most respectable cabinet ministers, those who are most explicitly part of the establishment and are hoped by Bay Street, which is our Wall Street. It is hoped that they will restrain him against any Trump-like shenanigans. Those people were all in Harris's cabinet back in the 90s.
Speaking of Bay Street, what is your relation to Ford's politics? Are they hoping that he will do their bidding? They're afraid he's out of control? How do they feel?
As with Trump, probably most of Bay Street voted for him for tax reasons. On the other hand, I think that they were very embarrassed by his brother Rob's shenanigans as mayor of Toronto. And they will do all they can, I think, to try to restrain Doug from looking like a Yahoo in that respect. They will relish the public-private partnerships in which they'll be able to invest and rip off the public sector. They will be worried, and I think they probably are worried, that any shenanigans on his part will get in the way of investment coming into Toronto, or Toronto being seen as a world-class city, all that stuff that the Chamber of, the equivalent of the Chambers of Commerce here, known as the Board of Trade, play on. I don't think they admire a capitalist figure like this. On the other hand, they can live with him.
In conclusion, let's put this into a global context. Ford's victory now is just the latest in the string. We saw Erdogan's election victory the other day in Turkey. You've got Hungary. You've got Nazis in office in Austria. You've got the foolishness going on in Italy. What sense can we make of the rise of this sometimes comical authoritarian Yahoo figure?
Well, I think, tragically, that this is the result of the parties of the working classes, very broadly speaking, who let the capacities of working class people, their political, their intelligent capacities, their ability to know something about the world they live in and respond to it in a collective, intelligent way, they let that atrophy. This has been a very long process. It goes back to the complete loss of political education in these parties and the way they played to leadership and media-oriented politics. But it most concretely, of course, has to do with the effects of neoliberal globalization and free trade on working-class communities. The growth in inequality, the loss of jobs, that's absolutely true, etc. And they therefore have left people to be mobilized by political charlatans, by cynical patriots. And since nationalism was always a alternative to class identity, and indeed one of the ways in which class identity was created, because as it got tied to the nation state, these guys, very cynically, are using this kind of, since we're watching the World Cup, you know, this kind of my favorite team politics cast in nationalist terms, which is xenophobic above all, and looks soccer hooligan in many respects. They've been able to capture this aspect of popular culture. And they, as you said at the beginning, they marry it with the tax cuts they offered to the ruling classes in a way that is really problematic.
Well, speaking of those elites, they seem really, they're happy to get the tax cuts, but they're also very concerned about a lot of these policies, yet they seem unable to do anything about it. What has happened to the class composition at the high end?
We'll have to see. I'm not yet convinced that in the long run, the American multinationals won't be able to do something about it. But yes, I think that this does show the relative autonomy of the state. You know, it's never been the case, in my view, that the ruling class is unified, the capitalist class is internally competitive. Even when it's monopolies competing with one another, they compete with one another over rates of profit, over access to capital, over their stock market valuations. They don't have a unified say in which thereby one of them picks up the phone and says the ruling class Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Doug Ford wants you to do this today. That isn't how it works. Governments do a reading at the best of what the balance of forces is amongst capitalists. But that isn't all they do. They often provide a lead. And these guys are providing a nationalist lead. Now, it's the kind of lead that leads multinational corporations especially to tear their hair out. And I think businesses in general, when they don't know the rules. You know, the United States Trade Representative, that office, would spend years meeting with the individual firms and the associations in each sector to try to work out a consensus amongst them of what they should be bargaining for and negotiating in each trade round, indeed in each bilateral trade agreement. What you saw with Harley-Davidson yesterday was the way in which what Trump is doing is completely unnegotiated in a collective way with the class. And, you know, they're not getting, and therefore the whole thing is very jerky because the state is not organizing the class. It's one of the main functions of a capitalist state. And as with fascist regimes, one of their great problems was their great distance from the function of organizing the class always made whatever they did very jerky, very uncontinuous, etc. And we're seeing this in this case.
That was Leo Panitch, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at York University in Toronto. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. A song of National Anthem by Lana Del Rey. Next, sex, gender, biology, behavior. Cordelia Fine was on this show to discuss her book Delusions of Gender back in 2010. In that book, she refuted all the nonsense that circulates about alleged biological differences between men and women, differences that are wrongly thought to determine the gender hierarchies of society. The sequel to that book, Testosterone Rex, was published earlier this year in paperback by W.W. Norton. The book is a critical look at the myths surrounding that hormone and the constellation of beliefs that hold women and men to be fundamentally different. And by saying this, I don't mean to uphold the gender binary. The fluidity of gender is one of the things that should help undermine all these biologically based beliefs. Cordelia Fine is a psychologist and professor of history and philosophy of science at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Your book reminds me of a quote, I think it was Stephen Jay Gould who said this, that you can find an example in nature to prove almost anything you want to. Why do we want to prove things out of nature?
Well, look, I suppose I can only answer this in relation to the contested space of differences between the sexes and to what degree they explain the inequalities that we still see. And I've always been very particularly focused on occupational inequalities. In particular, the sort of so-called horizontal segregation with women occupying occupations like, you know, nursing, teaching and so on, and men being, you know, very much more strongly represented in certain areas of STEM, and then also the vertical segregation in terms of whatever industry or occupation you look at, even if you actually have female dominance at entry level, the higher up you look, the fewer women you see and the more men you see, relatively speaking. I've sort of long been fascinated with this question of, you know, what does nature, what does biology, what does evolution, what does testosterone have to say about why these inequalities persist even in our 30-odd years after the implementation of, you know, equal employment opportunity law and so on. And what does that mean for the prospects of change?
You say so at some point, people, if they were honest, they could say, you know, I'm actually fine with the existing distribution of positions by gender, and I don't want to do anything about it. But it's much easier to say it's all nature, that men are by nature aggressive and women are by nature nurturing. Men are promiscuous, women are careful and homebodies. It's much easier to blame nature for all that, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it sort of tells us that there's the hard work has more or less been done. There's a little bit of tinkering around the edges. But if you look at the strong segregation that you see, both the sort of horizontal and vertical segregation, and you say, look, we can't really find explanations for this in natural differences between men and women, then that seems like there's still a lot of work to be done. Whereas if you see this as people sort of just, look, this is a particular view that's been put forward, that men and women sort of naturally are on average predisposed to different kinds of trade-offs in life and different kinds of interests, then what we see is, to some extent, people just sort of expressing different natures, and there's far less to be concerned about. So it does seem like much less work ahead if that's the position that's taken.
When you start talking this way, people will say male brains and female brains are just different. It's a fact of nature. First of all, is that true? And second of all, doesn't matter if it's true at all.
Those questions are often kind of lumped together and not thought about separately. So I think, yeah, it's great that you asked that kind of two-part question. So sex, by sex here, I mean biological sex. I mean the genetic and hormonal components of sex do influence brain structure, brain development. So we don't have asexual brains. But I suppose over the past decades, the argument has really been focused on, well, look, what are the differences between the brains of men and women? How different are they? Are they small differences, big differences? And what implications do they actually have for whether men and women tend to think, feel and behave differently? And those are really important questions. So in Delusions of Gender, I sort of pointed out that a lot of the data sort of looking at sex differences in the brain in humans were just, you know, based on small samples. They just weren't reliable data and they tended not to be replicated. The second question about what differences tend to mean is also a really important one, because we have a tendency when we think about sex differences in biology to always be thinking, how does a sex difference in biology make men and women behave differently? So whether we're talking about brains or hormones, we think, you know, how does men's greater testosterone levels make them behave differently? How do men's different brains make them behave differently? But another question that one can ask is, actually, when you look at decades of behavioral research, you find that although there are average population differences on various sort of gender traits, not only do these sort of vary a lot across time and place and context, there's also generally a huge amount of overlap between how men and women behave. So a different question one can ask is, how is it that men and women are able to behave so similarly overall and to be so responsive to particular contexts and cultures and so on, despite having very different levels of testosterone or the fact that you see these sex differences in the brain? One of the sort of the most uncontroversial sex differences in the brain is that on average the male brain is larger than the female brain. And so this raises the question of, whenever you do see differences, for example, in connectivity between, you know, populations of males and populations of females, are you actually seeing a sex difference? Are you seeing a difference between larger brains and smaller brains? There may just be good reasons for a larger brain to have different kinds of patterns of connectivity than a smaller brain. So actually what seems like a sex difference may actually be something that is compensating for another difference to enable similarity of behavior. And there are even examples of this in non-human animals, where you have kind of two sex differences canceling each other out in order to enable the animals to behave in similar kinds of ways.
The classic thing is that men are aggressive, men are risk takers, women are not. Is there any basis at all to this extreme generalization?
Yeah, look, so I focus largely on risk-taking in my book, because I've always been interested in the kinds of characteristics that are drawn on to explain why we see occupational inequality. So, I mean, I do talk about aggression. So the largest sex difference there is in physical aggression, but thankfully in most modern workplaces, physical aggression is not really something that's a reliable route to success in most professions. And when you look at what's called indirect aggression or verbal aggression, so, you know, everyone knows what verbal aggression is, and indirect aggression is sort of reputational slurs or sort of being mean about other people. They're the differences are very small. But so I largely focus on risk taking. And this is a really interesting area because the thinking around what risk taking is has changed in the past decade or so. So we used to assume that risk taking is just a sort of personality trait, and we used to assume it was a masculine personality trait. So, it's a very gendered characteristic. So we tell people that they should grow some balls. We talk about, you know, manning up. We talk about big, hairy, audacious goals in management sort of jargon. So it's a very gendered characteristic. So what was assumed in the past was that, you know, people sort of would fall somewhere on this dimension of risk taking. And so even the way that the questionnaires were devised had this assumption built into them. So people asked about, you know, would you take this kind of financial risk? Would you take this medical risk? Would you take this social risk? And they discovered that these questionnaires actually weren't very good at predicting the actual risks that people would take in the real world. And that is probably because people are very idiosyncratic in the kinds of risks that they take. So someone who is a physical risk taker is not necessarily any more likely than someone who's physically risk averse to be a social risk taker or a financial risk taker, for example. So this is really interesting in relation to differences between the sexes for a couple of reasons. So one is that now we have to understand, you know, why is it that someone would take financial risks but not want to jump out of an airplane attached to a parachute? And the reason for individual differences in propensity to take risk is not terribly surprising. It's to do with not risk attitude per se, so nobody really likes risk for the sake of risk itself, but to do with the perception of the likely benefits and risks of taking that. What that opens the door to is really thinking about, well, it's not that women, they have a more averse attitude towards risk, but that in a gendered world, those costs and benefits may actually be quite different for women or men, whether you're talking about a casual sexual encounter or whether you're talking about taking risks in the workplace. And of course, people's perceptions of risks are very much bound up in their experiences, their gendered norms, their self-concepts, how they think they'll be perceived by others if things go wrong. And these things could all be very influenced by gendered norms, gendered self-concepts, and simply sort of simple basic biases in the workplace, for example. But the other aspect of it is that when you look at sex differences in risk-taking, it kind of depends what domain of risk you're talking about. So there are some areas of risk where women are at least as likely to take risks as men are. And actually, since writing Testosterone Rex, some colleagues and I, this is work led by Tekla Morgenroth at the University of Exeter, we actually looked at within specific domains of risk where men sometimes and not always are seen as being more risk-taking, like physical risk-taking. And we actually made the effort to look at forms of physical risk-taking that don't normally make it onto the questionnaires. And our reasoning here is that because risk-taking is so strongly linked with masculinity in our minds, that as scientists, when you put together questionnaires, you know, you have to decide what kind of risks are going to go into your questionnaire. And we really drew on an observation by the economist Julie Nelson that the kinds of risks that women tend to take tend not to get noticed. They sort of fly under the research radar. So we just made the effort to think of more gender-neutral or more sort of female-typical kinds of risks and put them in our questionnaires. And we found that, lo and behold, when you do that, even when you match as much as you can to the actual objective risks of the situation, you find that those sex differences in risk-taking disappear or even reverse, so you have greater female risk-taking.
What would an example be of feminine risk-taking?
Well, we looked at sorts of activities that women tend to be more likely to do. Like, for example, horse riding is sort of a fairly risky sporting activity, but it's not one that tends to make it onto questionnaires. We also had different forms of financial risk taking that sort of moved beyond kind of traditional investment financial risks to be taking a financial risk on, you know, a cheaper flight that, you know, if the flight was cancelled, then you'd lose all your money and things like that. So just things that were a little bit less gendered.
I'm speaking with the psychologist and historian of science, Cordelia Fine, author of Testosterone Rex from Norton. You have a chapter that if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, it might still be around. Is there any truth to that?
I think what troubles me about that kind of narrative that women's natural risk aversion will compensate for men's sort of natural risk taking is sort of a number of difficulties with it. One is that when you look at the actual data on men and women and financial risk-taking, the differences are really modest. There's a huge amount of overlap. Knowing whether someone is a man or a woman is not a good guide to whether they're sort of above or below average in financial risk-taking. Then when you look at the, actually, this is sort of people who work in economics and finance have been interested in, well, what about the women and men who actually work in, you know, work in corporate roles or work in finance? What are they like? Are they like the are they like the sort of general population? And there was a research recently by Elizabeth Sheedy at Macquarie University here in Australia who looked at risk-taking propensities in a large number of financial institutions in Australia, the UK and Canada. And she found, again, sort of vanishingly small differences in the people who in sort of risk-taking propensity in those in amongst people who work there in terms of their to what extent they attended to risk or worried about risk in their workplaces. And what she found was much more important was cultural issues around how seriously do people take risk and the persons whose job it is to manage risk. How do managers respond to bad news? Do they have a kind of head in the sand, I don't want to know approach, or do they take it sort of seriously and deal with it proactively? So these sort of cultural issues around managing risk, which is the stuff that's the hard work that organizations have to do and financial institutions have to do to ensure that kind of crisis doesn't occur again, that's the kind of hard work that has to be done rather than bringing in more women in the hope that they'll sort of temper men's recklessness. It attributes the blame to, in some cases, literally to testosterone as opposed to the serious cultural and systemic factors that were really behind the crisis.
Yeah, well, let's talk a bit about the testosterone of your title. It's blamed for many things. It's supposed to be the causative element for men's aggressiveness, men's risk-taking. The absence of it explains women's nurturance and all that business. But you report several experiments in which the level of testosterone depends upon the environment, right? It's not necessarily that the cause runs outward from testosterone. Sometimes testosterone reflects a social environment.
Testosterone Rex is a sort of story about the evolution of science in the areas of sex differences in different kinds of disciplines. So evolutionary biology, in hormone behavior research, in neuroscience, in behavioral science. And this is another example where there has been this sort of really important scientific shift in thinking away from thinking about hormones like testosterone as being simply drivers of behavior, though of course testosterone does influence the brain, but rather as testosterone as the kind of middleman, so to speak, for enabling us, other animals, to kind of respond flexibly to the environments that we find ourselves in. So in ourselves and in other animals, testosterone levels actually respond to particular kinds of social contexts and social behaviors. So as you rightly said, rather than driving us towards particular kinds of behaviors, it's actually kind of responding to our social environments. The kinds of situations that we find ourselves in are, of course, you know, part of gender. So one nice study showing exactly this kind of effect was work by Sari van Anders. She looked at what happens to men and women's testosterone levels when they enact sort of power. So they got to you know, simulate firing someone from a job. And she found that women's testosterone levels rose when they fired someone. She didn't see an effect in men, actually, though that may be because it's harder to demonstrate increases in men because of the sort of generally higher baseline that they're working from. So this is an example of what is a sort of gendered situation. So whether or not somebody, a woman or a man, is in a position to exert that power over someone else is, of course, a facet of gender that changes across time and place. It's actually influencing hormonal response. And there are several other kind of really nice examples of that dread word, gender construction, influencing testosterone levels.
In this post-Harvey Weinstein era, the era of Me Too, we've seen an awful lot of explanations for the kinds of behavior that Weinstein made famous. This is just the way men are, there's a vulgar Twitter version of this, men are trash. There's an awful lot of essentialist judgments that this is just the way men behave. How do you see that? Is there anything to this position, or do we need to de-essentialize that as well?
Yeah, look, so I think there are a number of different approaches to thinking about this. So one is, you know, there's this very common perception that men are kind of evolutionarily designed to be sort of seeking multiple mates. And, you know, we all know the kind of story, cheap sperm, huge reproductive potential if you have many, many partners, you know, preferably young, fertile ones. And so, you know, men have evolved to have this particular drive to seek a variety of partners. And I suppose people might link that to sexually harassing behavior in the workplace. It's a bit of a stretch, but I suppose it's sort of sexually related behavior. So one thing to say about that is actually when you break down the statistics of this, there are particular situations where it is possible for men to produce a large number of offspring from having multiple partners. But the interesting thing about human reproduction is that it's really, really inefficient. So we, unlike many other species and many other mammals, our sexual behavior is not hormonally coordinated. And that means that we have a huge amount of sexual activity that will not lead to reproduction. So the sort of hit rate of producing an offspring from sexual activity, and this is even assuming that, you know, that you're having heterosexual intercourse that could theoretically produce a baby as opposed to some other kind of sexual activity, you know, the hit rate is really low. So that means it's very, very time consuming to produce these sort of multiple offspring. So this idea that men are kind of wired for this sort of sexual promiscuity, you know, when you break down the statistics, it's not as compelling a story as you might think. But I think the other aspect of it is there is a study that does show that the way we think about men's sexually aggressive behavior, when we think of it in terms of that kind of, well, they've evolved to behave in that way, it does actually influence, even though it shouldn't, it does actually influence people's perception of their responsibility for engaging in sexually aggressive behavior, and also even how morally problematic we find the behavior itself. So this is just an example of how our scientific explanations of gendered behavior is actually having a subtle, does appear to be having a subtle effect on how seriously we take that kind of behavior and how much responsibility we hold the perpetrators to account. I teach ethical leadership at the Melbourne Business School, and, you know, ultimately we can talk about evolution and hormones as much as we like, but if sexual harassment was taken extremely seriously in terms of disciplinary action, and if people felt that they could speak up about it and report it and something would be done and that they would not suffer from that in terms of their own careers, then I'm sure all of these purported hormonal and evolutionary effects would reduce radically very quickly.
But people are deeply invested, even scientists who should know better, are deeply invested in these, I don't know, morality tales of biological explanations for complex social behavior. It's really hard to fight against them. Where do you start? How do you restructure this social world? When we say something is a social construction, it is a social construction, but that means it's very complicated and very durable. So how do we break out of this? People are deeply invested in these stories of sex difference. How do we fight those, and how do we get to a more humane, gender egalitarian society?
Ah, oh, that's a $1 million question. Look, I suppose from my point of view, I care a great deal about the science and the quality of the science and the rigor of the science in this area. And one sort of hopeful progress that I see that is very hopeful is that, you know, people have been critiquing these kinds of scientific explanations for a long time. And what I'm seeing much more of now is those critiques sort of making it into mainstream scientific journals and discourse. So, and this is part because, you know, we have endocrinologists, neuroscientists, biologists who are sort of bringing that feminist frame into their scientific research. And they're, you know, very well established and respected scientists. And so that makes a big difference. So I have very positive feelings about science as a self-correcting process and the important role of these kinds of critiques, and not just critiques, but actually generation of new data. So thinking about the models developing, challenging these long unexamined assumptions, asking different research questions, producing new data and generating new hypotheses and theories. I mean, this is all going on. This is sort of part of the implicit story of testosterone X, is all this incredible work that's been going on that has been challenging these old views of sex differences and how they develop. So I think from the scientific point of view, we're very much on the right track, although I have sort of lingering concerns about how sort of the sort of denigration of feminism and the role of that kind of work in science. But I think in terms of sort of more broadly in terms of the social picture, yes, it's incredibly hard because there's so much redundancy built into gender as a system that you can sort of chip away at one aspect of it, but there are many others that will kind of fill in the gap, so to speak. So you can sort of chip away at the number of women on boards, but, you know, what about the pipeline? What about early childhood where these sort of stereotypes and schemas are developing and so on? So there are no silver bullets, unfortunately. And I think the important thing is for these interventions to, as much as possible and as much as is practical, to be evidence-based and to sort of share knowledge across industries, across different kinds of organizations, even across countries as to what works and what doesn't.
That was Cordelia Fine, a psychologist and historian of science at the University of Melbourne. Her book, Testosterone Rex, came out in paperback earlier this year from Norton. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, one of the greatest songs about gender ever written, Lola, as covered by the Raincoats. Till next week, bye.
I met her in a club down in Oldstone, where they drink champagne, and it tastes just like cherry coke.